Welcome to the Law Report. I'm Anita Barrow. Today, a timely discussion on wills, capacity and power of attorney. The government's intergenerational report says that by 2055, a quarter of Australians will be over 65. More of us will live very long lives, well into our 80s, even 90s. A lot of us, though, may decline in our functions, experience memory loss, develop dementia. And then it might be too late to make our wishes known about how we leave our estate. But even if we make all those plans, we can still be vulnerable to financial abuse. And sadly, many of those responsible are in our own family.
A mother with dementia was moved from her home by her daughter and without the knowledge of her son, who lived in the UK. She was taken to live with the daughter's family and was locked in a bedroom. The mother executed a power of attorney at a time when she lacked capacity. Her house was sold without her knowledge, and the funds were used to pay off the mortgage on the daughter's house and to buy a car.
A nephew would present his aunt with a blank cheque and tell her he was going to purchase groceries. He would fill in the amount himself after she signed, and then he would make the cheque out for thousands of dollars.
Stories like these are becoming increasingly common. Conservative figures say 5% of the elderly suffer some kind of financial abuse, but it's likely much higher, as much of it's hidden. Victims suffer in silence. Later, we'll look at Victoria's new laws that will tighten rules around power of attorney. But first, to provide some perspective, John Watkins is the CEO of Alzheimer's Australia New South Wales branch. He's also a former Deputy Premier.
Well, it's big and it's getting bigger very quickly. Across Australia today, there's an estimated 340,000 people living with dementia. That's dramatically increasing as the baby boomer generation moves through their 60s, 70s and beyond. Within 15 years, that 340,000 will go to just over 500,000. If you hit 85 in Australia today, about one in four will have some form of dementia. And just one other example, today in Australia there's about 4,000 people who are over the age of 100. By mid-century, that will be 70,000 Australians estimated to be over 100. Just a good indicator of how we're ageing very quickly.
And I must admit I was shocked to read, and I couldn't quite come to these figures, 1,800 new cases of dementia in Australia diagnosed each week.
Again, that's just the size of this sort of tidal wave that's, it's already the first edges of it are with us. And accordingly, dementia is now the second leading cause of death in Australia after heart disease. Now, with it, there are positives. We're the first generation in the history of this planet to expect to see your grandkids grow to adulthood, and more often than not now, for a lot of people, they're great-grandchildren. And that's been driven by our great health system and other factors. But with it come the challenges of ageing, and some of those challenges are the other social, taxation, legal challenges that come with such a large cohort of our community becoming old pretty quickly, and many of that cohort having issues in relation to cognition.
So let's talk about that. Let's bring in Kate Brewer. Kate's a Brisbane barrister specialising in estate litigation. When talking about capacity, Kate, does having a cognitive decline like dementia necessarily mean that you're unable to make your wishes known about how you leave your estate?
Not necessarily. People can be in the early stages and even the mid stages of dementia and still have capacity to make a will. It's all relative and it's a question of the particular facts. It's difficult in estate litigation because the court has to assess retrospectively, usually, what somebody's capacity to make a will might be, because often it's not assessed properly at the time.
So what's the test for will-making capacity, or as it's called, testamentary capacity?
Testamentary capacity. It's a relatively low test when we're talking about the different sort of types of capacity. The person has to be able to understand what a will is. They have to understand what their assets are, what they own, what they've got to give away, and they have to understand the people, the persons that they should be considering who to leave that to. So, for example, they might have three children and they want to disinherit one child and leave everything to two children. They have to understand that they have three children and be able to articulate a reason why they are wanting to disinherit a child. Then that sort of ticks that box. And then there's an overriding test that if they're suffering from some kind of illness, such as dementia, that affects their reasoning in relation to one of those limbs, those three sort of limbs that I discussed, then that will mean that they don't have capacity. And if I can give you an example for dementia, it's quite common, doctors tell us in these cases, that it's very common because of the short-term memory loss. A person with dementia may put a lot more weight on somebody who is there with them, helping them at the time. You know, they may give insufficient weight or incorrect weight more so than others.
And joining the conversation here on the Law Report is Solicitor Pamela Sutter. Now, she's the chair of the Elder Law Committee of the New South Wales Law Society and past co-chair of the Australian Law Council's National Elder Law and Succession Law Committee. And Pamela, this test is based on a 19th century case, Banks v. Goodfellow. Can you describe this case?
Well, it's still a very relevant case. For instance, I have an imaginary friend. That's a delusion. But if I am able, despite his existence and that delusion, to still make a will, acknowledging it's a will, acknowledging what my assets are, acknowledging the real persons to whom I have a responsibility, that delusion won't necessarily affect my capacity.
And this case, I mean, in the John Banks v. Goodfellow case, he was in the 19th century in the UK. He thought his butcher was going to kill him, even though the butcher had died more than a decade before. But despite that, the judge ruled that he had the capacity to understand what a will was and to make his wishes felt.
Yes, despite the greater learning about the functioning of the mind, it's still a pretty good test, and it sets out what a solicitor is trying to do, making a will which is proper and appropriate if you haven't got a lot of connection with reality, such as your age, the names of your children. They will send you off to a doctor or a psychologist to assess your capacity, having sent the doctor an appropriate letter as to the questions and the considerations. But in those sort of borderline capacity cases, that evidence of the solicitor is of immense importance.
John Watkins, dementia can develop over 10, 15 years, and there are periods of clarity and incapacity. What issues does this raise in terms of making your wishes known?
It's a very difficult condition. It impacts on each individual differently, and it depends on the type of dementia that you have. Alzheimer's disease is the most common form of dementia. It's about 60% of all dementias. Its classic symptoms are those loss of memories, especially short-term memory, what you did this morning, what the names of your children, but vivid memories of what happened to you 70 years ago. But it depends on what age that it hits, how quickly it goes. Another form of dementia may be frontotemporal, which is probably about 10% of dementias, where memory is generally not impacted on that heavily, but there may be quite drastic personality change. And that's the issue with on a particular day getting a legal instrument drawn. It depends on the particular capacity on that day.
For example, can that make a person vulnerable to manipulation? There have been recent cases where a family member has persuaded a mother to make a new will favouring them, and it's difficult to prove the mother was really consenting to it.
To then be able to prove post that event that the person had the capacity 2 years ago when they drew their will after dementia had started can be a very difficult thing in a court. Hence, the need for all older Australians to actually get a will, write a will, get a power of attorney before they start to lose capacity. Because once the dementia journey starts, it may be an issue later on if someone needs to prove whether or not you had the capacity to draw up the will when you did.
Of course, if somebody does not have capacity, it's not too late because all states in Australia have jurisdiction to have a court-made will for somebody who doesn't have capacity. So that's another topic altogether, of course.
Or if you haven't written a will at all.
If you haven't written a will at all, or if you have a will and you lose capacity and that will is no longer suitable to your needs, for example, your beneficiaries might have died. The more common cases of court-made wills are people who... There was a recent Queensland case where a lady had dementia and her son went through a family law property dispute, separated from his wife, basically. An application was made on her behalf saying that if she had capacity and she knew that her son and his wife were divorcing, she would change her will to exclude the daughter-in-law and provide some better protection by way of asset protection for the son from the family court proceedings. And that was disallowed at first instance but went to the Court of Appeal. You know, there's lots of court-made will applications are becoming much more popular these days, and no doubt will become much more popular as we have the ageing population and the increase, as John's talking about, with the numbers of people with dementia.
Already the 85s and older are the fastest growing in Australia. So if a parent has dementia, what about what's being described as inheritance in patients? The kids are now presumably around in their 50s, they're planning their retirement. Do you think there's an element of financial abuse because of a sense of entitlement?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
I would say probably half the cases that come across my desk nowadays have issues about people misusing powers of attorney whilst the person was alive. So number of children, one daughter tends to be the one that mum moves in with, and she's got the power of attorney, and so she's looking after mum's finances and often, you know, uses mum's internet banking for her. And at some point in time, mum goes into a nursing home, and you're looking at bank statements. This is all post-death that I'm looking at it. You're looking at bank statements, and mum's gone into a nursing home in March, and then in April and May there's purchases through iTunes, and there's the purchases at the Louis Vuitton store in Melbourne when mum's in the nursing home at the Gold Coast. There are lots of cases like that, and they're often, I think, they arise a lot of the time out of the attorney having no idea about what their actual duties are to the person that they're an attorney for.
And it's difficult to say. We did some work on this, and it's very difficult to actually identify how much financial abuse is happening, because overwhelmingly it appears it's happening within the family unit, and people tend to want to keep that private. It may be the only children in the family abusing their single parent, in which case it's very difficult for it to get out. It could be one child abusing a parent and other siblings discovering it and stopping it, but still not wanting that to become public and perhaps not reporting it to authorities.
John Watkins, he's the CEO of Alzheimer's Australia New South Wales branch. Anita Barrow here with the Law Report on RN Radio Australia and ABC News Radio, with a conversation about dementia and estates.
A daughter and her partner, who has power of attorney, moved in with her mum, who has dementia. The couple has four children and they decided the house was too small, so they sold it and purchased a new two-storey home. The mother is in a small room downstairs with a bathroom in the family laundry.
An unemployed man moved in with his mother to care for her, but in fact he spent all her money on drugs and alcohol and she could not recognise it. Neighbours suspected it was happening but were helpless to support this lady who refused to acknowledge her dementia or her son's abuse.
Now, we are all told that we need to write a will and prepare for a time when we may lose our functions. We need to appoint an enduring guardian to look after our lifestyle and domestic needs. We need to make an advanced care directive too. And for our financial affairs, we need to appoint an enduring power of attorney. But as we've been hearing, family members or even so-called friends adopted during a fragile time of our lives, those closest to us can abuse that power. So what is an enduring power of attorney, and is there a way to stem financial abuse? John Watkins from Alzheimer's Australia, Brisbane barrister Kate Brewer and Sydney solicitor Pamela Sutter.
Power of attorney is one of the most powerful documents that is possible, because under it the attorney can do anything financially.
There is one thing that an attorney can't do, and they can't make a will for a person, just given that that's the conversation we've been talking about earlier. That's right. What Pamela's saying is correct. The power is very broad. It's pretty much anything you can do, your attorney can do for you, with very, very limited exceptions. And so they can sell all your assets. They can sell the house that you live in, clean out your bank accounts. Now, they have duties that they owe to you, that they need to keep proper accounts and they need to do everything in your own interests and not allow it to conflict with their interests. But in the first place, they do have the power to do it. So it's very, very important that you appoint somebody as an attorney that you trust 100%. Sometimes I see people who have three children and they appoint all three children as attorneys. In my view, that's a very bad idea because it usually leads to some kind of disagreement, arguing or fights between the children, and then you end up in a court or a tribunal in any event. So you need to pick one, you need to play favourites, and you need to pick one person who's going to be the best person at managing your money. No point appointing your son who lives in Singapore and isn't around to be able to do anything. And if you don't have somebody that you trust 100%, well, you need to look at other options like appointing a trustee company, the public trustee, if funds don't allow the sorts of fees that trustee companies appoint. But the public trustee acts as the financial administrator and the attorney for many Queenslanders, and I'm sure that in other states it's the same. And private trustee companies do this sort of thing.
And they would be regulated, would they?
And they are. They're highly regulated, and they do a very good job managing people's monies. Of course, there has to be a certain amount there to warrant the fees that a trustee company charges, but that's a good option.
John Watkins, can you describe the case of Anna?
Sure, Anita. And this was a very disturbing case that was brought to our attention through one of our carers. Anna was diagnosed with dementia in 2002. She was in her late 70s. Now, prior to that, she'd done the right things and drawn up a will and during power of attorney. But one of her daughters, who was not the enduring power of attorney, moved closer to the mother, ingratiated herself, if you will, with her, took her to her own solicitor, at her suggestion had the will changed, had the enduring power of attorney changed to make her the power of attorney. The rest of the family are unaware of any of this happening. She then placed her mother in residential care without telling her siblings, and then started to withdraw money from the account of her mother up to $300,000, then put the property up for sale. Eventually, the other siblings found what was happening and took it to the guardianship tribunal, as it was then in New South Wales, and the guardianship tribunal intervened and were able to take some action. It didn't return the assets, the funds, but it did, at the end, provide some protection for this older woman with dementia. The police apparently said in the case that if this had been done by someone who didn't have an enduring power of attorney, they could take action.
Why weren't the other children informed of the change of power of attorney?
There is no requirement for anybody to be given notice of the fact that an enduring power of attorney is entered into. The only requirement is if you are an existing attorney and that power of attorney is revoked, you need to be given notice of the revocation, but you don't need to be given notice of the fact that there's a new one made, and nobody is required to be given notice of the fact that an EPA has been made.
So how can we avoid stories like Anna? And there are many, many of them. Are there reforms to the regulations around power of attorney that could help? John Watkins?
Anita, firstly, widespread education and awareness campaign. We've got some structures that help. Let's get Australian people signing up to them. That needs to be culturally appropriate. We would argue you could do things like making it mandatory to have an enduring power of attorney, an enduring guardian appointed as a condition of entry, say, to a residential aged care facility. We believe that having a public advocate in every state with powers to investigate abuse of powers of attorney is warranted. And I think we can go as far as suggesting that there be a regulation or a registration system in place for powers of attorney so that things cannot be changed without families knowing. But I know that it establishes a whole new regulatory structure, which is a difficult step to take.
Pamela Sutter, you're not so convinced about registering enduring power of attorney, are you?
First of all, registration costs are high. Secondly, there is the privacy issue, and a lot of people don't want the existence of the power of attorney known. Thirdly, registration at the time is probably of not much utility, because very often people go to the grave and that power of attorney remains sitting in my strong room packet, never used.
Kate?
I'm in favour of registration of powers of attorney before they can be used. So not necessarily upon being made, but before they can be used. There are difficulties with it. It would be a costly system, and Pamela's touched on a couple of reasons there about how do you register them, what sort of system do you put in place. But I think that's a reform that needs to be looked at.
Brisbane barrister Kate Brewer, who specialises in estate litigation, John Watkins, CEO of Alzheimer's Australia New South Wales branch, and Sydney solicitor Pamela Sutter, who's a long-time chair of the Elder Law Committee of the New South Wales Law Society and past co-chair of the Australian Law Council's Elder and Succession Law Committee. David Andrew is a senior advisor at State Trustees in Victoria on matters including estates and power of attorney. He recognises stories like Anna's are difficult to solve.
The reality is there's always going to be problems, because the issue is not in the powers, it's the abuse of the powers. I mean, even now, someone who accepted the role of attorney undertakes to act in the best interests of the donor, we call them, and not act in a position of conflict, but that doesn't always occur.
Victoria's changing its rules around power of attorney in a few weeks' time, in September. What are the main changes?
It'll be more formal. There'll be greater powers to the regulating body, some concepts which are altered, like a new supportive attorney, so quite a number of changes. I think probably what is significant is it's become more formal. Previously, you'd have to go to someone who could take a declaration, but that could be your local chemist or police officer. Now it will be someone who can take an affidavit, so it'll be a solicitor or a medical practitioner, and I think those people will be more au fait with things like capacity issues and more able to give explanations up front.
And I understand too, as part of the changes, there's been some more clarity around the issue of capacity.
Yes, they've actually written into the new bill about the meaning of capacity, so things like, does the person understand the information relevant to the decision they're making? Can they retain the information? Are they able to use, weigh up, assess all of the considerations to make a decision? Are they able to communicate it back? Interestingly enough, it actually starts from the concept of you're taken to have capacity until there is evidence to the contrary. So you will have capacity unless it's determined otherwise.
And how is it determined?
Ultimately, I suspect it's by a court or tribunals, but yes, on the basis of medical evidence.
You mentioned also this supportive role. What's the aim there?
The idea is for people to retain their independence and to be able to continue to make decisions, but with the assistance of someone else. So this supportive attorney would be someone who might obtain and collect information and convey the information, discuss the information. They might be an advocate for you, but ultimately the decision-making power will be with the principal, with the person making the decision. You know, someone might be able to make a day-to-day decision about, you know, having some spending money. Well, on a weekly basis, a different decision might be if you're going to sell a house or make those life-changing sorts of decisions. So it's going to depend upon the nature of the decision as to the involvement of that person.
Will these changes, do you think, help prevent abuse of power of attorney?
I think certainly that's the aim, and it's a good thing that you've got a new Act which is at least focusing its mind on these issues, and just the fact of these sorts of discussions, I think there's a greater awareness now in the community. That's important. The changes will be, I think there will be people who get more and better advice at the outset. I think there's a greater deterrent now because you've got administrative and civil tribunal actually having greater level of involvement and scrutiny over this area.
Have they got investigative power?
there are investigative powers, because ultimately what will occur is they will ask someone to come and to account, because when you're an attorney, you've got a duty to account for someone else's monies. If there are reservations about whether they're doing their job properly or not, there would be the power to revoke or cancel the power of attorney and make an administration order appointing someone else. That's going to be a good thing in the sense that where people abuse their power, there's now the ability to actually award compensation through VCAT rather than having to use the state courts, which might be more formal, more expensive, more difficult. There's also new offences created too, and there's going to be an offence of obtaining a power of attorney for the purpose of obtaining a financial advantage.
And this is a criminal offence?
Correct.
Would you, for example, support registration of power of attorneys? This has been raised by Alzheimer's Australia.
If you have a register, then it will obviously, you know, it's on the record, it's more transparent. But I think there would be a number of issues that you'd have to consider. If it was prior to activation, you're going to have privacy considerations. Someone might appoint a person, you know, family member, you know, son A, and it doesn't want family member B to know. Or it might appoint someone quite apart from family. It might appoint a trustee company and doesn't want the family members to know, because that could cause a greater conflict. So I'd also question, is it going to be mandatory? What's the consequence then if it's not registered? Does that mean it's not enforceable? And if there is this extra step, will it dissuade people from actually doing it? And I also think, Anita, that there's the practical considerations. Who maintains this register? Who holds it? What's the cost?
Well, so what advice would you give to help protect a person from the potential of financial abuse?
Look, I think there's probably about four things that I'd want to mention. I think I'd go for formality, independence, record keeping and scrutiny. In terms of formality, I'd rather have a power of attorney than not. It's very important that you've got a power of attorney and a will which are up to date and relevant. And that's much better than doing things on an informal basis. Secondly, I think independence. I think where you've got any concerns whatsoever, an independent person, independent body, like a trustee company within the state, is what you should be contemplating. That organisation will act in the best interest because they won't have the issues of conflict, they won't be involved in the family dynamics. Although, if you didn't want to do down that path, I think probably contemplating two people as attorneys, even though that has certain practical implications itself. The third thing was record keeping and insisting upon record keeping. Someone should be accounting for the use of someone else's funds. If there are loans, they should be documented. If there are change in living arrangements, it should be properly discussed, advice given and recorded. And then the last thing is the scrutiny side of things. Other family members or friends or a solicitor or accountant or whoever it might be should also be aware that someone else is acting so that they can have that level of security before damage is done.
David Andrew, a senior advisor to state trustees in Victoria. This is only one small part of a complex and increasing issue as we age. The message, as always, be prepared. It's estimated up to 50% of us fail to write a will or to prepare for a future where our faculties may not be as sharp as they are now. And for those who've concerns about suspected elder abuse, all states and territories have an elder abuse hotline. Alzheimer's Australia has the National Dementia Helpline. The number is 1800 100 500. That's 1800 100 500. And that's it for the Law Report today. Producer is Matthew Crawford. Technical producer is John Jacobs. I'm Anita Barrow. Thanks for your company.